I can dig it up if I want to do. But. Hi, everyone. We're in Bergen, Norway. Todd Taylor. Today is, what is today? Today is Wednesday?
Thursday.
August 7th.
Yeah.
2015. We're at the Electronic Literature Conference with Bergen, Utah. Bergen, Norway. Cheryl Ball and Todd Taylor talking about 4.3C Online. Shoot.
I love that I asked Todd if I could just record this informally, and he just jumps into, like, documentarian mode and introduces himself. Thank you. You're so awesome.
Yeah, I've done way too much of this. In fact, that's what I mostly teach is the documentary research mode as a digital composition for my students. So.
That's very cool. Okay, so I wanted to talk to you about the original 3Cs Online, and the conversation may spin out, of course, from there. Is it going to be okay for you?
Oh, it's great.
I think it's okay. And it'll pick up what it picks up, because this is totally, like, on my stupid iPhone. Okay, so I was telling you about the piece that Doug and I were writing about History of a Broken Thing, which is about the multi-journal special issue, and, like, how part of that, the reason why that's broken is because many of the journals went offline for years at a time, and the URLs were completely disintegrated. But 3Cs Online never came back. And then, like, it seemed like NCTE never, they wouldn't even talk about it. They wouldn't even acknowledge that it had existed at some point. So I was like, oh, well, Tom was the editor of that. So I was curious about your history with it. Because all I'm able to find is, because my only context with it is knowing that Krause's piece, which we can retrieve from the Internet Archive.
I thought he archived it himself now.
He did, but then that went offline too.
Oh, shit.
And then Kairos republished it in the 12.1 issue or something like that.
Yeah.
With further commentary.
To get to the end game, because things are developing so fast in the electronic world, the only way for 3C Online to survive would have been, some kind of chain where I handed it to Colin handed it to Bump, and Bump handed it to somebody else, and it would continuously be upgraded, which is essential. The Krause piece, and there was one other, and I'm sorry the name escapes me. Please put it in as if I knew what it was. We did.
I can't track it down.
We did publish. I can find it for you. We published two electronic pieces, and they're basic hypertext. They would be easy to archive.
Yeah.
And I forget where that baton got handed off. I think it was Colin, whom I think about the only thing I said to him when I handed off 3C Online was, we committed to publishing forever these two electronic pieces. And to me, it's very important that I honor that, that I do everything I can to make sure that happened. And then when Bump took over, I said the same thing to both he and Krause, that, sort of mission one should be to make sure we maintain this archive
right.
of things. And
the archive was gone by then.
I think what happened is that at first NCTE was understandably resistant to the idea of publishing a full text version online.
So why did they let you do it in the first place? Like, how did you even get involved with that?
Let me finish that thought and I'll get back to that. And so as NCTE started to become heavily invested in online publishing through its membership services, then the interest in kind of maintaining something outside of that waned. I think really it's up to the editors. Whoever is the editor at the time is really going to guide the 3C Online editor. And so how I got started originally was Joe Harris and I had a pretty good relationship, and I'd been sort of lobbying him as the editor of 3Cs to do this kind of thing, and he was very much behind the idea, to the point where they actually had a search and they interviewed at 3Cs a number of people, I don't know who else was included, for the editorship, and then I received it, and that was based on a proposal for what it would look like and what it would do. And my two sort of incremental goals were, first of all, to get NCT to the point that we all knew they were going to get to eventually, which was some access to full-text versions. And then it was very important to me that we have written in everything about the journal that electronic submissions were encouraged. In fact, I made it a specific point, and I was on the 4C's executive committee at the time, that an electronic publication in 3C Online should be considered for the Braddock Award. That was, you know, it was in the lines of the description of the Braddock Award that it could be an electronic text. That was, at that point, published in 3C Online. Now, I didn't have any delusions about that likely competing for that award, but obviously it seemed very important that it was considered in the same conversation. That the online version wasn't some degenerate or ancillary thing, that it was every bit as significant as a print article. So those were my two agenda for 3C Online as I created it. A lot of the work at first was just coding all out. You know, all the HTML, you know. And I think I went through two or three different interfaces, which were, I think they were Flash-based. No, they wouldn't have been. I can't remember. I think I had a Flash cover, and then once you got inside, there was a menu that, you know, when you scrolled over the, you know, the buttons changed, which was really advanced for the time, you know. And so it was,
were the buttons the sun?
No, that was kind of an icon at some points. I think that was the home, and then it was like the different segments of the different pieces of it. A big thing that we did was, you know, and one of the reasons I think that NCT and the executive committee was so interested in it was there was no publication of those, you know, those essential position statements. And students write to their own language.
Oh, really?
Everything that we published was like you couldn't find it. You had to go to the journal that was, you know, would publish the statement 6 months, a year later. And then as these things were always being updated, the latest version would come out in the journal years later. And I said, you know, these are public documents. They need to be in circulation. So one of the original initial features of 3C Online was we were the first place to publish all of those position statements that came from 4Cs or NCTE. So, you know, that was one of the segments. And then, you know, if I was, you know, the vanguard arguing that full text would help and not hurt NCTE and 4Cs from day one, Joe Harris was a little bit behind me and didn't quite believe that. And then NCTE was way far behind that. They really were afraid of the idea. They really disliked the idea. Additionally, at that time, they basically had no web presence. I mean, you know, it just didn't exist. And their ability to...
this was in 2001-ish.
I can't even remember the dates, but... You know, their ability to, like, publish on the web just was kind of non-existent. So they were in transition. They were spending lots of money and lots of effort trying to figure out how to organize a web presence, and that's still going on. That was a big part of Kathy Yancey's chair of 4Cs, was getting the website more contemporary, let's say. And that's happened a little bit. So it was. There was nothing there. I mean, I did all the coding myself. I had to argue that it really should be hosted on NCTE servers, and that was a logistical obstacle that took weeks to overcome. All I said is just, you know, give me access to your servers, you know, and I'll go in there and I'll code it all myself. And, you know, they had, like, the one IT guy who was, like, nervous about giving me access and eventually figured out a way to give me a directory. And so I built it all, and at first I did not have permission to publish anything full text. So originally, if I remember correctly, I would publish editorials, I would publish letters, responses, I would publish the titles of each piece and an abstract of each piece. I tried to develop an interactive forum where people would send me email and I would edit it and publish it. And the thinking at that point was we didn't want it to be open. Not that there were a lot of examples of open sort of conversational things. But we tried to get that going and it never went anywhere. The idea was if you wanted to say something in response to an article, send me an email. I'd kind of clean it up and then publish it. And then people would encourage. So when you opened up, you know, an issue, it looked like the cover. But then each article was a hypertextual link to a separate page that was kind of a metadata index of everything, the author, the date, an abstract, and then links to potential forums to talk about that article. I think maybe we had 5 people ever say anything, right?
I remember that, though. I remember that option being there.
Yeah.
and thinking, oh God, people aren't writing in.
And so the process was that, you know, NCTE would send the journal on a CD-ROM disk and PDF to the printer, the publisher. At the same time, they would send me a copy of it. And I would take the PDFs, and I would cut and paste everything into HTML so that, ideally, although it never always worked out this way, you know, a couple of weeks before it was ever printed, you could see the skeleton, the index, the table of contents of the issue. So you'd have some sense of what's coming. And then it was also a service to NCTE and 4Cs in terms of publishing announcements and calls for applications and grant programs and, you know, like I said, the position statements. So that was the early days. And then at the end of it, I was also involved. I took the 4C bibliography from print into online. At the same time, in fact, just literally weeks before Compile came out.
Oh, wow.
So the 4C bibliographies were compiled all into, you know, six, eight, ten editions of them were compiled into one, you know, MySQL database that was hosted at UNC. And it worked great, and it was nice, but then Compile came out, and we had no plans to extend the bibliography. We just wanted to publish all that work, and then Compile kind of absorbed all that work. At the same time, I was on the MLA Bibliography Committee because there was an agreement between NCTE and MLA to have the MLA Bibliography be the index for NCTE publications. So they're professional bibliographers who spend all day, every day in an office in New York City indexing material in our field. And since I knew that from the end of my tenure at 3C Online on, that everything was going to be indexed anyway. In fact, they were also working not just forward, but backward to cover some things. I wasn't too terribly worried about providing an index for 3C Online because at that point also JSTOR came out. Yeah. And they had an agreement with NCTE to publish all their journals, and that would obviously be professionally indexed. And I thought, well, you know, there's the full text archive of everything. It's JSTOR now. It's, you know, and the economic model made it only logical to let JSTOR handle all that, because NCTE and Urbana was not about to try to get in that business. So that's kind of where things transitioned from. You know, by the time I was done, there was going to be a house for full text, and it wasn't going to compete with journal subscriptions and membership dues. And then Colin took it over, and I think Colin's essential move was exactly the right one for the time, which was to create an index or metadata to the sort of the whole corpus. And he worked, as far as I could tell, I didn't really talk with him very much about it, with him and his crew, to create a pretty robust index to it, so that it would be something more than what you would get if you went to JSTOR or you went to NCTE's site and searched through their access to the online journals. And I thought that was a good move. I'm pretty sure he did drop the archiving of Krause's piece, which I objected to, but it was his baby at that point. I didn't want to get too involved.
Well, from what I understood, so there was just the one issue that published, like, these full-text pieces. Is that right? That Krause's piece was in? Or was there more than one issue that did that?
You know, at the end, I feel like I had gotten some permission to publish some full-text things. Hmm. But I don't remember exactly. Now, when it came to the online pieces, I mean, Krause's piece was hypertextual.
Right.
So there was no way to print it in the actual thing.
Right. Were there any other hypertextual pieces?
There were two. It was
Krause's and somebody else's.
Yeah, somebody else's. I think, and the somebody else actually preceded Krause's.
Oh. Okay.
And they were based. They're very rudimentary. I mean,
oh yeah, because his is listed as like 1.2 or 2.1.
I don't remember how.
If you look at the file directory in the URLs in Internet Archive, it's listed as 2.1, which I was like, oh, so there was must have been a 1.1, and I couldn't remember, like, retrospectively, I couldn't remember once the archive had disappeared. But so it had originally been on a very rudimentary NCTE website.
Yeah.
But then when
I'm sure that I built edited, you know, whatever Krause sent me into the and transported it into the website. I mean, he designed it and then I made it fit within whatever directory NCTE gave me.
Right. And then when Colin and them took over, they wouldn't house it on the NCTE website. For whatever reason, I don't know. I have to talk to Colin more about it. Because that's when they got the Inventio.cc or cc.inventio or something like that website.
That was always a tension. Because I wanted it to be in NCTE's web servers because I wanted them to own it, take control of it, mostly because I wanted to have an influence on the way NCTE thought about scholarly publishing. But they had too many other concerns. I mean, just keeping membership files organized. And actually, there was one point where Cindy Self and I were working on an idea of a directory, like a directory of everybody who's a member, and I don't know if that ever happened. And so NCTE was always struggling to keep up. And it was this tension. It would have been better to just publish it in my own domain. You know, I published the 4C bibliography in iBiblio, which is literally, like, you know, 50 yards from my office. And that eventually broke because they updated to a new version of all that software, and then the programmer who built the original one wasn't there anymore, and then no one could figure out how to make it work again. So, you know, it's always this tension. It's like, do you want to be in a platform that is very centrally maintained in exchange for a lack of specific functionality? It's the same problem with CM, you know, with course management systems. It's like, you know, well, in fact, Dan Anderson and I built a peer exchange JavaScript-based thing. They gave us a programmer. He spent like a year and, you know, all of his salary building us this tool that was made obsolete when Blackboard came out. You know, because like, now you can do these rudimentary functions. Not exactly the way a writing teacher would want them done, but it was ubiquitous and it was all connected to passwords and registration. And so it's always that tension between doing something central or out of the box or building your own. Yeah, that's always tough.
Are you surprised that... Well, I'll say it this way. I'm surprised that more than 10 years later, NCTE is still falling behind on understanding the technical infrastructure that they need to run these kinds of things.
I'm not surprised anymore after being in the factory and seeing how the sausage is made. I mean, you worked for a while in Illinois, and so you were pretty close to them. And they just don't have the financial and personnel resources that MLA does in New York City with a bibliography, with a huge budget. I mean, there's like some huge majority of MLA's budget comes, or at least used to come, from their selling that bibliography.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, I forget. I mean, I want to say over 50% of their revenue came from that bibliography. I don't know if that was still the case. I don't know if I should be citing that, but NCTE, as a nonprofit professional organization, is, I think, understandably and severely limited to austerity. And really isn't in a position to be out there at the cutting edge of these things. And so I think they rely on people like you and me at the time to try to push them as far as they can go with what they've got. And it's always going to be frustrating and disappointing that they're going to be behind, but you just keep plugging, and eventually full text happens. And I would love to see, of course, you know, because it's kind of a legacy of mine, but, you know, in this world of digital development, you're just used to the rapid consumption of things becoming obsolete. You know, I'd love to see it reinvented and reinvigorated, and I think that argument wouldn't be too hard to make and wouldn't be too expensive. But again, it would take someone like you to say, okay, we're going to create a place within NCTE to practice what everyone is preaching now from K through 12 to post-secondary about, you know, digital composition.
And that's what I don't understand, is that, I mean, with the most recent iteration, they still couldn't get their technological act together, right? I mean, the fact that I'm sure it was more than me went to NZTE to say, where's your server space for this? Because we saw what happened with the previous two iterations of 3Cs Online. So, like, how are you going to host this? How are you going to maintain this? How are you going to keep this sustainable? And they didn't have any answers, and so they ended up publishing it on Dropbox. And I'm like, you know, and putting it in the lap of a poor tenure-track faculty member, like, who didn't have the resources to manage those kinds of things. And now they're talking about doing it again.
Yeah.
They're actually talking about reviving 3Cs Online for a fourth time.
Well, now that Jonathan, well, now that Jonathan's there, right? He, you know,
but
Jonathan's got enough to worry about. I mean, you know,
Jonathan's got enough to worry about, and he's only there for what, 3 years? It's a 3-year term, or is it a 5-year term?
Well, usually it's three, but it kind of gets bled into more. But most people are burnt out after three. There's a lot of pressure editing a journal that big, and so you know, if there's anyone who could listen, who would be John. I mean, Kathy. You know, Kathy was extremely open to these ideas, but making it happen financially and logistically within NCT, that's a whole other thing.
Well, and I think that there's a... I'm pretty sure that Kathy has heard me rail about this issue on multiple occasions. Yeah. She's probably sick of it. And so there's this, you know, there was always this tension when I was on the Seven Seas Committee about what the Seven Seas could propose in its annual report versus what NCTE could actually do, right? And it wasn't even the executive committee. So for a while, when I was learning about how things worked, I'd be like, well, why isn't the EC voting to, like, get wireless at the conference or to, you know, do certain things? And folks on the EC, half of whom, by the time I left the 4Cs organization, like, they were computers and writing people. So they knew and they agreed, but they couldn't get it done for whatever reason. And I'm like, oh, okay, it's not the people in the field. It's Urbana-Champaign, you know, which is a really, I don't know.
You know, I think if anyone's going to make it happen, you just have to, the same thing, you know, I think with 3C Online, you just have to take responsibility for yourself. You just have to jock it yourself, which is a problem because you wanted to develop it to hand it off. So it's perpetuating, you know. But
do you think they should even bother now?
Sure. I think they should. I think for just a matter of integrity is, you know, you read all the material coming out of NCTE about multimodal everything, and in terms of the integrity of practicing what you preach, you then, you know, publish stuff that doesn't pay attention to this. You know? I mean, now, you know, you probably sensed it for a long time, still today. I have a real hard time forcing myself to think in terms of print publishing. Just because, and I'm not saying this is right for everyone, I'm just saying for myself, it's just a non sequitur to talk about new media published in the old way.
Right.
So, you know, I think it will take somebody who's really ready to be the fight and be a zealot and think about a sustainable way to do this so that it does get handed off and so someone isn't perpetually stuck with it. But you think about, look at NCT, how so much of what's done is that way. I mean, the RNF is the same people running it. The 4 7 Cs is the same people taking responsibility for it. It just, that's the, kind of the nature of a professional volunteer organization. And then, you know, I really, I can't believe I just blacked out his name. Kent. I love Kent. And we had so many conversations about these things. And he was all for it. And I think if it didn't happen, it was because of the literal economic and logistic constraints that are in the home office. I just don't think they have abundant revenue. And so I don't even know what infrastructure or platform they're using to deliver their current versions of their journals. I don't know what that is, but that's got to be expensive and difficult for them. And
they're not delivering them online, though. I mean, they're just doing JSTOR. They're doing the print-based. They're not putting anything on the website.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But I mean, you can get, you know, I can read the journal currently digitally with my you know, subscription that's current.
Oh, right.
There's no other feature to it.
Right.
You know, there's no other feature to the journal. I thought, who was it? Was it the new college English editor I was reading was trying to do something interactive?
Huh.
Maybe I got that wrong. I don't remember.
So, you mentioned earlier that you had all the old files for Three Seas Online.
Sure.
In part because of this chapter that Doug and I wrote, he decided to revive this idea that Doug would have to tell the story, the history for sure. But from my understanding, so Mick used to joke about, you know, we shouldn't call it Kairos, we should call it Stasis.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's like sometimes things just don't come out the way that you, on the schedule that you anticipate. And so our 20th anniversary issue is in January.
Oh, wow.
I know, can you believe it?
I'm trying to think, well, that is that January 96. Okay.
Yeah. January 1st, 1996. So we're going to publish on the actual anniversary date, and as part of that issue, we're going to release a new section, a new project. It's a Kairos project called Stasis, and it's Doug's plan to recover important rhetoric and techno-rhetoric texts that are on the potential of being lost, right, that are on that verge of potentially being lost from the web, and so we should maybe think about getting your files if you're interested in
that. Sure, I'm happy to share them. You know, I have those.
I don't know that how much permission we would have to get.
I have two pieces that I've now got to the point where I'm going to be like, even though there are, let's say, potentially copyright issues, that I'm just going to start putting out there.
Do it.
One is that Stanford piece. Were you at Stanford in 2005?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Three screens?
Yeah.
You know, how can you publish that?
Yeah. Like, where else has that been after Stanford?
Well, because there was so much copywritten material in it.
Oh. Kairos doesn't care.
there's that.
Fair use. Buggers.
Well, the fair use definition has changed with that statement from the Library of Congress that said that university professors are allowed to use short pieces of film.
Right.
That changes everything as far as I'm concerned, because that's what I do.
Yeah.
For critical purposes.
I didn't need Library of Congress to tell me that. We've just been doing that. That's been part of the critical discourse.
But that's the other problem. We, you know, working for government or institutions or NCT can't fudge those lines.
Right.
I mean, NCT can't afford to get sued.
Right.
Or, you know, any state, you know, any letter they get, they've got to pay for lawyers now. Well, Kairos will just go, okay, fine. Because no one's going to sue you.
No, you don't have anything.
You know, so, and exactly. Then the other thing is, you know, JAC's Remembering Composition disc.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, that didn't get, you know, circulation like it should have.
Yep.
So that should, I'm going to, you know, in fact, it's actually been sitting on my desk because I got a Vimeo Pro account to archive all of the student films that I'm collecting.
Right.
And part of what I was going to do was upload those two pieces in there, but maybe Kairos can convince me that it's better. Maybe I put it in Vimeo and it's connected or whatever, but, you know.
We would love to host those for you under Stasis because, great. I mean, hopefully our 20-year track record has proven that we will be responsible for those kinds of things, at least for another 20 years.
Cool.
Until the web disappears, and then we'll still have the internet, so.
Yeah, because it goes, you know, that stuff goes to the politics of, you know, electronic scholarship. It's like,
yeah,
people don't know how to cite Remembering Composition.
Right.
How do you cite that? How do you cite, you know, 15 minute 23? Yeah.
I know.
Well, I mean, you know, but like, you know, you've been dealing with this for decades now, right?
So but most people don't have any clue.
Yeah.
Yeah. How would you cite it?
Oh, well, I would, you know, I would put the time code.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The time code as a la page number.
Well,
in
no, just so you can find what you're referring to.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, if you're citing a book, then you're going to cite the page number that the block quote is from or something like that, you know, because that is the most specific index that you can get.
Right.
But in a movie, it's the time code.
Right.
Yeah.
But then, you know, well, what if you have a hypertextual database, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, we started putting, we've been sloppy about this as we're learning how to cite all these different media types, but I'll add in the file name. Like, if we're citing a specific hypertext, instead of just, like, doing NP, you know, no page, I'll be like, no, this is on, you know, index2.html.
Right.
And some people have been like, what the hell is that? I'm like, that's the quote-unquote page number.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay.
Well, it's Janice Walker and I.
Oh, yeah.
95. We're graduate students. I think it was 2 years ahead of her, maybe. And we were talking about citation, and she comes from a legal background. She was a legal researcher.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Before she was an academic, and so she was very much about citation style and precedent and, you know, being able to refer to the exact case file and stuff like that. So her mind just naturally worked that way. And then I was explaining the other day that my first job with JAC was doing the bib checks. So I thought bibliographically. And we were talking about, you know, she put together a little style manual for citing because there was nothing out there that did it right. And like, I remember it was like this 1 month that Chicago, MLA, and I don't think APA, but APA was working on like the new citation manual for the electronic age, right? Even said so on the cover.
Right.
Like, we're like, oh, well, I'm sure they'll figure it out, right? And they came out with it and was all wrong.
Yeah, all wrong.
And Janice and I were like, what should we do? And I just like, let's go. You know, and one thing led to another, and that became the Columbia Guide to Online Style. And so the part of my primary contribution to that was this whole section on the logic of citation, which is actually the thing that's been most cited and I get the most feedback on from like information library science people all over the world. It's like, this is great, thank you for writing this. So in order to occupy a space that takes us from where we were to where we want to be, the mechanism of citation is essential. And so you get penalized to some extent for going out there beyond the border and creating things like New Media Composition Live or The End of Composition in 2005, or that DVD, Remembering Composition, which no one knew how to cite, and just isn't in circulation, and it's not searchable. Which is why the secret title, or the original title of the presentation tomorrow, was actually The Ontology of the Database. Have I told you this yet?
No.
Okay, so, like, I have this concept of, like, everywhere I go, I talk about this, it's like, I want to create, a whole new journal of alt scholarship called Haiku Scholarship, where it's a title and...
so are you.
It's a title and one word, and that's the whole article. And it's peer-reviewed. It's like haiku scholarship, right? Anyway, so I've had this essay in my mind for a decade. Anyway, it's called The Ontology of the Database, and it has one line. It says, if it isn't in the matrix, it isn't. And that's it. And that's kind of the point I'm making tomorrow about platform being the message, is now, if it isn't searchable, if it isn't tagged, if it can't be found and accessed, then it doesn't exist anymore. And it's in the new digital ontology.
Right. I was explaining to a more junior computers and writing-ish scholar that...
We're still going? We are.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Oh, man, we're getting some good gain there. I was explaining to a junior computers and writing scholar why her website, her new website, wasn't ranking high in Google, in her Google search.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, have you ever heard of PageRank? Like the PageRank algorithm. And she was like, oh no. Yeah. And I was like, well, lucky for you, we've got a web text coming out in the August issue all about PageRank and what it means. But I'm like, there's that, you know, there's so much knowledge in our field that we lose from generation to generation. And you're a generation ahead of me, if not two, in the field. So there's like all of this knowledge that you hold that I'm like, oh yeah, like the editing piece that you were talking about yesterday, from, you said you published, oh, what was it? It was something that you and Gary published.
No, there was The Politics of Electronic Scholarship,
yeah,
in a SUNY anthology called Publishing and Retcomp. But then there was also the editorial that I wrote that no one read called Hyper Editing. It was in a special issue of TTYC on technology. And I also wrote an editorial that was physically published in 3C's, the actual physical thing, which was, it was 3C2K, so it would have been 2000, about the new millennium and the new epistemological approaches to scholarship. And no one ever has ever said one word to me about either of those pieces.
Like, where was the second one?
It was physically in the print journal in 3Cs.
Oh, and weird.
No one has ever, as far as I know, has ever cited it, ever referred to it, ever said word one to me about it.
No, I didn't even know about it.
That's right.
All right, now I'm going to have to go look it up.
That's right. Well, I, probably not. I'm probably like, well, I shouldn't say anything. I'm not even going to look at it, actually.
No, because you've published all sorts of really cool nuggets in your entire career, and they should all be cited more. I mean, you've been at the forefront of so much of this.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's leapt so, you know, I've become obsolete so quickly in this. Everyone becomes obsolete so quickly. My first video editing was so funny. I remember they had this student who interviewed our local congressman, whose name is David Price, still in, you know, nice liberal, Chapel Hill, still in office. And to get 10 minutes of, like, grainy 300-pixel video, we had to have two external CD-ROMs, an internal CD-ROM, and the hard drive almost completely wiped. It took 22 hours to process 10 minutes of real-time video, right?
Jeez.
And I learned all of this with a company, a digital startup called Zoom Culture, which was in Chapel Hill, and was doing exactly what YouTube has done, but they didn't make it. I was like, it's just a matter of timing. It's like they had the concept of YouTube, and they were giving us equipment because they needed content. So my students were out filming things, and we were publishing it there. And that's how I learned filmmaking, is from this startup company that became Zoom Culture that was... right idea, wrong time. And then the YouTube, I mean, they had the concept of YouTube, and then YouTube comes along and is what it is now. And you just accept that. That's part of this territory of, you know, you push the boundary and then you quickly get lapped.
Well, I mean, the way that I think of it is you were 10 years too soon, right? Great ideas, but that, you know, I mean, you published a lot of, when you look back, you published a lot of stuff that was like 5 or 6 years before other people started picking it up and talking about it. And by then they've forgotten, right? It's like the student not knowing about PageRank. That it's information that you and I 5, 10 years ago would have been like, yeah, of course it's PageRank, like that's how it works. But then it skips, right? It skips the knowledge, it skips the
It does, but it also, it also kind of accumulates. You know, lugging projectors and video equipment, you know, to conferences, blowing out wheels on, you know, suitcases. And now, you know, I remember like literally carrying like hundreds of pounds of equipment to just, you know, put up my little flash documents, you know, in 1997 or whatever it was.
Right.
And then came the moment where I just bring a DVD. I didn't even bring a computer anymore. I just slapped in my DVD, and that's all I had to bring. And so I'm happy to see things progress, and I think you can't be too invested in finding your stuff obsolete, especially if you feel like you really made a difference in pushing things forward. I mean, Kairos obviously has made a huge difference, and it's great that it's been sustained, but it could have easily... you know, falling off a cliff.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, you know, to me, not the greatest, but one of the greatest contributions of Kairos, which is what I'm getting at in some ways in the talk tomorrow, is its development and review process is unlike, you know, it really kind of reflected but also changed a sensibility about how scholarship should be developed and peer-reviewed and edited. And it had to be done that way because of the difficulties of new forms. And so, you know, you're going to get tired of Kairos at some point, and you're going to want to hand it off to somebody at some point.
Yep.
And who knows what may happen then, but no matter what, you did push the profession and other journals in that direction. I remember 1994 at 4C's, I think it was in Nashville. It might have been 95. I think it was 94. Where JAC would have its annual board meeting. And like back then, it was a heavy hitter. I mean, it was like all the important people were on the board. I think Derrida was on our board.
Oh,
right? You know, he wasn't there in Nashville, unfortunately. We were all sitting around. I was this little grad student. And I'm like, I think we should have an online version of the journal. So when you go on to the World Wide Web, which everyone's like, yeah, whatever that is, you know, that's like email, right? You can get a copy of the journal. And they literally all laughed at me. I mean, they just almost passed out. They were laughing so hard. You know, and it was actually at that same meeting I went up to Victor Vitanza and I was like, hey, you know, we're thinking, you know, thinking about trying to work on, you know, multi, you know, publishing, you know, back then we didn't call it multi, although it was multimedia. We're, you know, thinking about working on publishing, you know, in kind of, you know, pretext kind of way, things that are visual as much as it. And he was like, oh, I'm not really interested in that. You know, he was like, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Oh my God. I'm not sure he would admit to that today.
Oh no, he would. I mean, everything he's doing right now is visual. Not everything, but a lot of it is. So, yeah, I mean, yeah. that's just the nature of the territory.
Yeah. Do you remember when you, since you mentioned to me that you were on the original editorial board for Kairos?
Yes.
Yeah. So, when I look back at the archives for, you know, I look back at the email archives from the editorial board a lot, and I've spent some research time on it in the last couple of years. It's truly amazing how much we still have of that. It's like over like 3,000 pages, I think, single spaced pages of data that can never be released. Yeah. But the archives start in 1998 because I think that's when Yahoo Groups started. And so
I was never centrally involved. I mean, like when we get to computers and writing, I would always like sit down at the meeting, and I really loved what they were doing, and I was, you know, doing 3C online at the time. And I helped, you know, edit some of the early texts, but I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't working on every issue. Yeah. So I have no real specific memory of what was happening at the earliest days, other than it was clearly the right idea. The one thing I do remember, I bet you remember this too, I'm pretty sure it was C&W in Mike Day's place in Dakota. North Dakota, South Dakota.
Oh, yeah, at the mining the mining school. That was before I joined the field.
Were you at that conference?
No, I didn't. My first C&W was 2001.
Okay, so first of all, it was the most gothic conference you've ever been, because it's actually tragically. So you pull into this town. I probably shouldn't say that, but that's all right. No, it's all right. Mike's not there anymore.
And you know, he stepped in at the last minute with like 4 months to spare to host the conference, because there wasn't going to be a conference that year. So he knows it was a little rough around the edges.
And we pulled into this town, and there's like hotels everywhere. There's nothing. When we're not near Mount Rushmore. It's like there's nothing there. And there are all these hotels. I'm like, why are there so many hotels here? And someone locally said, well, the Native American reservation doesn't have electricity. So in the winter, they're housed in these hotels. Just like gothically oppressive. And the hotel we were in was like literally under renovation. We're like, the restaurant wasn't open. They just had like these trays of food in these conference rooms. And you literally were stepping over piles of concrete rubble that were being like blown down by jackhammers to get from one part of the conference hotel to the other, and it was just mind-blowing. And I'm pretty sure it was that, but correct me, because maybe where I remember this moment so distinctly, we're at the big banquet, like the usual only used to be one sort of plenary banquet. And Cindy Self was up there talking about the community, the Cambridge and Reading community, and talking about, like, she did this sort of poll, like, how many of you are reading College English, and like, you know, 10 people are reading. How many of you are reading 3Cs? Like 10 people raised their hand. How many of you are reading, you know, computers in you know, her journal?
Yeah.
And like, you know, half the room raised their hand. And like, how many of you are reading Kairos? And everyone raised their hand.
What?
Everyone raised their hand. Like, and I remember Cindy kind of, you know, and we all kind of went,
uh-oh.
What happened? It was like at this moment, like, everyone is reading Kairos.
Wow.
I guess you weren't there for that moment. That was like, that was the chaotic moment.
That must have been, was that 97 or 98? I can't remember which.
I think it was there, but I can't remember where it was.
Wow.
Oh, that was funny.
That's, well, we're proud of the little journal.
Yeah.
The little journal that could.
Well, and, you know, and the other thing was, you know, it started out being people who were not mainstream. They weren't tenured. They were mostly graduate students. You know, obviously Mick's position in the field was never central in that regard. And so because of that, and because it took Doug so long to finish his dissertation and get a job, you know, it had this...
No, that's not quite true.
Well, whatever. You know.
It took him so long to go back to get his PhD. But it only took him 4 years to finish.
It always had this sense of being not, I don't want to say top tier, but being run by ancillary people. But then it starts, at that moment, I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is becoming central because of its accessibility and its design and its concept being aggressive. Mm-hmm. So.
We worry a lot about it becoming too stable. Like there are, you know, Mike Edwards, who's the Topoi editor, he and I have had conversations in the past about the Topoi genre has solidified in some ways that we're both uncomfortable with, because there is a requirement for a certain level of scholarly apparatus in those particular section web texts that makes it less experimental, oftentimes, than I would like it to be. So we're still, you know, trying to push against that, but it's so easy to write words.
Yeah.
It's so easy to write words. And frankly, these days, it's easy for people to slap together a Prezi or a shitty video and throw it up on YouTube and send us the link for that. And, you know, we don't publish a lot of that stuff, but I shouldn't probably say that.
Well, you know, I think it's just all incremental. I mean... You and I, you know, we go to these conferences and we see these exhibits of this really cutting edge stuff, and we're like, we want it all to look like that, or not just look like that, function like that. But it just takes time. I mean, you know, I want Krause's piece to be forever archived. Although, I mean, I'm even embarrassed to some. I'm embarrassed by the editing cut of the 2003 piece. You know, New Media Composition Live, and there's so much wrong with it, you know, but I want people to see it because that was a stepping stone.
Yeah.
And so
that piece was crucial for so many scholars at a particular moment in time. It was such a big deal at Four Seas that year. That was the one at Four Seas, right? I mean,
yeah.
That you walked in that room, and the way that the layout was, I mean, there must have been 1,000 people in that room.
We didn't sleep at all. We took a van of audiovisual equipment from Chapel Hill through the tunnel. This is right after, you know, 9/11, right? And, like, no one stopped us. And we pulled up, and we parked it, like, literally in the first parking spot. In the parking lot. They're like, oh, that van's big. Just park it here. And just unloaded thousands of dollars and 9 projectors and 10 screens and then we had the live band.
Oh, that's right.
Playing with a horn section.
Right.
Oh my god. And Joe Harden played the keyboards, and we didn't have a keyboard. And the opening song was Superstition. And the way we did it was Bump went into a recording studio in Chapel Hill and laid down the bass track and the drum track on recording so that everything was synchronized to that. And then he played guitar and sang live. Joe Harden played keyboards live. And then we had a horn section. And so to get a keyboard, we literally like went across Broadway in the rain to this address we were given, which ended up being David Letterman's like studio. And, like, we went in this room where, like, there was, like, 500 keyboards. And, like, this guy just, like, pulls out one and goes, there you go. And we're, like, wheeling this monstrous thing across Broadway in the rain.
Oh, jeez.
Right? And then we're setting up, you know, we completely rearranged the whole auditorium and had all these crazy ideas and wraparound screens. And then Bump's like, you know what this section, this song really needs? It really needs a horn section. Stevie Wonder's Superstition. It really needs horns. I'm like, okay. So he goes to Kathy Yancey. He's like, any budget left over for this? And she's like, sure. How much do you need? He's like, I don't know, $500. She's like, okay. And he just went down to like the local Giant Music store and said, I need a horn section. And the guy was like, give him 3 numbers. Called these guys up. They showed up, you know, 2 hours before the performance. And, you know, Bump arranged them to play the horns on Stevie Wonder's Superstition.
Oh my God, that's fabulous.
funny. And I mean, I've never been so exhausted in my whole life. I did not sleep the whole night setting up the room. Bump did go to sleep to try to have a voice that he could sing. And the original concept was, you know, obviously a year earlier, Kathy Yancey was the chair of the program, and I said, you know, we need to do something that can't be replicated any other way. You have to be in that room to get it. And she loved the idea, and I originally went up to Ann Wysocki, and I said, you know, let's do this together. And she says, well, I kind of have this other idea, this other thing I want to do. And so the arrangement of the room physically, because we were actually in New York when Kathy and I were coming in with the concept, and so we physically went over to the hotel, and we looked at the space, and we said, well, there's like this auditorium, and there's this sort of anteroom. And it's like, well, we can have like an installation and a performance. And then Anne was like, well, I'll dig the installation space. And she did that amazing piece there.
Yeah.
And they worked together, kind of, sort of. And, you know, there were two, the fundamental structure of it was two screens, where one screen was supposed to be kind of commenting on the other. But it really wasn't that good, which is why in 2005, when I went to Stanford, I said, well, let's do three screens. Oh, here's the funny thing about that thing. It's like, I had no idea how I was going to get three screens to synchronize. Right. I just knew that I wanted them, and I wanted it all to be very syncopated to music and stuff. And the way it worked was, you don't need this stuff. Though. The way it worked was, in Final Cut Pro, there's three video channels. And then one audio channel. And so what I did is I built all three video channels for left screen, center, and right screen. And then I exported three different versions of it. One for the left channel, one for the middle channel, one for the right channel. And then I had no idea if this would work. But I burned each channel to a different DVD. I bought three identical DVD players. And I put the DVDs in each of them. And I used one remote to hit play.
Yeah.
And it worked. And I couldn't believe that it worked. Like, they all launched perfectly symmetrically, and they stayed in perfect timing.
Wow.
So it was three. It was one DVD player for each channel. And I showed up in Stanford, and these guys are like, well, what are you going to do? I'm like, I bought three DVD players. And they're like, oh, I wonder if that's going to work. And it did. And we couldn't believe that it worked.
You're like, watch this. Click. Yeah, so.
And it's, you know, it's that, it's knowing that there's more and just pushing yourself to try to figure it out and never, you know, feeling like you get it right the first time, but hoping that it's a wave that has repercussions. So, I mean, you know, Cindy and Gail, you know, took responsibility for their journal. And their publishing series, and eventually they got, I forget who's the publisher that
Elsevier.
Yeah. You got involved to be able to give them some infrastructure that they could rely on to keep the enterprise going. You know, and then people need that. And so, you know, I know that they've got a new editor, but you know, who's gonna really husband or take care of that? And the same thing with Kairos, unless you're gonna dedicate dedicate your life to it. Or develop graduate students to
I know it feels like it.
Yeah. Yeah, what's going to happen? So.
Well, that is the sole reason for Vega. I mean, yeah. Kairos is the absolute extreme example of the kind of journal that you can publish online, in my opinion. Like, there may be more extreme examples out there, but if we can build infrastructure that allows for human and technological sustainability for the most extreme example, then it's going to work for everything else regardless, right? So, I mean, yeah. that's the hope.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that in 2 years we have a system that makes this, that makes Kairos replicable.
Right.
You know, something like Kairos that other people want to do, which people do all the time. I mean, we get calls all the time asking, how do you do this?
Yeah.
I'm like, how many years do you have for me to explain to you? but if that training is built into the system, then there's a less of a hurdle, less of a learning curve there.
Yeah. And you know, and where does the revenue come from? You know, the economic model.
Yeah.
You know, you know, in general, it comes from, you know, you get to advance as a professional because of the great contribution that Kairos represents. We all know that the work of being an editor is wrongly not valued the way it should be, because it's more of a contribution in my mind to the field than publishing my one hit article. In fact, the very first, you'll love this, the very first talk I ever heard at Four Seas, which I think was 1994, was Christina Murphy, who was the editor of Composition Studies. And she was great. And she was the very first person to talk at the very first session I had. And the title of her paper, I'll never forget it, had something to do with editors as taxi drivers, not gatekeepers. The perception being that, you know, the editors are like standing at the gate and, you know, weaning out the worthy from the other one worthy. And she's like, that really doesn't describe my experience as an editor. I'm more like a taxi driver, you know, hustling all over the place to try to deliver people to their destinations. And I remember she was absolutely brilliant. I mean, she didn't even have note cards. And she just, like, talked perfectly. And I was always like, wow, I'm never going to be able to do that. And I don't think I still am. So, you know, that's one of the things that's so misunderstood about editing. And if you asked me, editing well done is more valuable than someone who just publishes hit articles every other year. And it's a lot more work. And it has a more expansive impact on the field. It's a bigger contribution, if you ask me. I mean, I understand that to some degree it's perceived to be mechanical because there's so many clerical and managerial dimensions to it. But intellectually, it's very demanding and has a huge result. And so how do you develop your baby Kairos or 3C online and hand it off to somebody else? Hope for the best. You develop Vega, I guess. I guess that's right.
Exactly. We gotta walk to dinner. All right, do we have anything more to say?
Oh, well, we have too much to say. Let's stop recording.
All right. Thank you. Sure.